Good morning. My name is Matthew Jordan, and I have the pleasure to read today's scripture for us. So hear the word of the Lord from Isaiah 34 and 35. You nations, come here and listen. You peoples, pay attention. Let the earth and all that fills it hear, the world and all that comes from it. The Lord is angry with all the nations, furious with all their armies. He will set them apart for destruction, giving them over to slaughter. Their slain will be thrown out, and the stench of their corpses will rise. The mountains will flow with their blood. All the stars in the sky will dissolve. The sky will roll up like a scroll, and its stars will all wither as leaves wither on the vine and foliage on the fig tree. When my sword has drunk its fill in the heavens, it will then come down on Edom and on the people I have set apart for destruction. The Lord's sword is covered with blood. It drips with fat, with the blood of lambs and goats, with the fat of the kidneys of rams. For the Lord has a sacrifice in Boaz, a great slaughter in the land of Edom. The wild oxen will be struck down with them, and young bulls with the mighty bulls. Their land will be soaked with blood, and their soil will be saturated with fat. For the Lord has a day of vengeance, a time of paying back Edom for its hostility against Zion. Edom's streams will be turned into pitch, her soil into sulfur. Her land will become burning pitch. It will never go out, day or night. Its smoke will go up forever. It will be desolate from generation to generation. No one will pass through it forever and ever. Eagle owls and herons will possess it, and long-eared owls and ravens will dwell there. The Lord will stretch out a measuring line and a plumb line over her for her destruction and chaos. No nobles will be left to proclaim a king, and all her princes will come to nothing. Her palaces will be overgrown with thorns, her fortified cities with thistles and briars. She will become a dwelling for jackals, an abode for ostriches. The desert creatures will meet hyenas, and one wild goat will call to another. Indeed, the night birds will stay there and will find a resting place. Sand partridges will make their nests there. They will lay and hatch their eggs and will gather their broods under their shadows. Indeed, the birds of prey will gather there, each with its mate. Search and read the scroll of the Lord. Not one of them will be missing. None will be lacking its mate, because he has ordered it by my mouth, and he will gather them by his spirit. He has cast the lot for them. His hand allotted their portion with a measuring line. They will possess it forever. They will dwell in it from generation to generation. The wilderness and the dry land will be glad. The desert will rejoice and blossom like a wildflower. It will blossom abundantly and will also rejoice with joy and singing. The glory of Lebanon will be given to it, the splendor of Carmel and Sharon. They will see the glory of the Lord, the splendor of our God. Strengthen the weak hands, steady the shaking knees. Say to the cowardly, be strong, do not fear. Here is your God. Vengeance is coming. God's retribution is coming. He will save you. Then the eyes of the blind will be opened, and the ears of the deaf unstopped. Then the lame will leap like a deer, and the tongue of the mute will sing for joy. For water will gush in the wilderness, and streams in the desert. The parched ground will become a pool, and the thirsty land springs. In the haunt of jackals, in their lairs, there will be grass, reeds, and papyrus. A road will be there, and a way. It will be called the Holy Way. The unclean will not travel on it, but it will be for the one who walks the path. Fools will not wander on it. There will be no lion there, and no vicious beast will go up on it. They will not be found there, but the redeemed will walk on it. And the ransomed of the Lord will return and come to Zion with singing, crowned with unending joy. Joy and gladness will overtake them, and sorrow and sighing will flee. This is God's holy and inspired word.
Well, good morning. And as I was contemplating this Valentine's Day, I thought, man, what passage could I choose that just really kind of fit in nicely, tightly, wonderfully with the day? And I thought, well, Isaiah 34. No, actually not, obviously. Isaiah 34. So this is the final sermon in our mini-series on cultivating a culture of evangelism. And don't worry, we're going to head back to Daniel next week. So we'll be in Daniel 4 next week. I look forward to that. And last week, we talked about how a culture of evangelism is built on oneness within a church. This week, we're going to talk about how a culture of evangelism is driven by our convictions about eternity. Specifically, that hell and heaven are real. If we really believe that, if we really owned that in our minds and hearts, would it change the way we evangelize? Now, Isaiah 34 and 35 paint a vivid picture about what hell and what heaven will look like someday. Now, we have to ask the question, why are these verses here in Isaiah? Well, it's to wake up Israel out of their spiritual slumber and strengthen their trust in the Lord. The book of Isaiah is all about getting Israel to trust God over these surrounding nations, and they were tempted to make allegiances and alliances with pagan nations such as Egypt or Assyria and then later Babylon. And Isaiah is calling them back to faith in God. Are they going to trust God or are they going to trust the nations? So Isaiah is the evangelist here, both to disobedient Israel as well as to the pagan nations. You know, recent stats show us that 75% of Christians say they should share the gospel, but only 50% do. Isn't that interesting? So, most folks, most Christians are convinced that the Bible teaches this is what I should do, but they don't follow through on what they see is clearly in the Bible. Now, why is that? Why do we struggle with evangelism? We know God changes hearts. I mean, if you need proof, just look around this room or think about churches you've been a part of, right? There's a few hundred people here at Faith Church. God clearly has used evangelistic efforts to save a people for himself. So why don't we evangelize? There's a lot of reasons. One common reason, I think, is fear. That kind of makes sense, right? Rico Tyson, in his book, Honest Evangelism, in fact, this book is at the pastor table. I'd encourage you to go pick it up. He talks about something called the pain line. It's the line you cross when you tell someone about Jesus, and then you may start to experience a little pain. Maybe it's rejection or mocking. You get into an argument. Sometimes you lose a friend over this, right? So why don't we evangelize? Well, Rico Tice would say sometimes we want to stay on the comfortable side of pain, of the pain line. So this morning I want to consider what's at stake if we stay on the comfortable side of the pain line. What happens if we choose silence over speaking? And this brings us back to Isaiah 34 and 35. Here's the main idea from these chapters. Feeling deeply unsettled by hell and hopeful for heaven will dramatically alter the way we approach the Christian life and mission. I'll say it again. Feeling deeply unsettled by hell and hopeful for heaven will dramatically alter the way we approach the Christian life and our mission. So in these chapters, God gives Isaiah this stark picture of the future of humanity. There's two outcomes for humanity: eternal judgment, we see that in chapter 34, and eternal joy, we see that in chapter 35. So friends, if we want a culture of evangelism here at Faith Church, we need to feel unsettled by hell. And we need to long more for heaven. So let's turn and look now at chapter 34. What do we see in this chapter? We see the wilderness of judgment, the wilderness of judgment. Now, this is one intense chapter, right? One of the most intense chapters in the Bible. It's hard to kind of absorb all of this information, all these pictures. It's so graphic and so violent and so scary. It makes us feel uncomfortable. Well, you know, that's exactly what it's meant to do. The whole chapter uses poetry, these images, to grab Israel's attention, grab the nation's attention, and unsettle them, to push them to trust God alone for salvation. And it pushes us too. Who is in view for this end time judgment? Well, notice verse 1, the nations, the peoples, all the peoples. And later we see in verses 5, 6, and 8, Edom in particular is in view. Now, why pick on this little nation of Edom? What did they do wrong? Well, when little Israel journeyed to the promised land, they asked Edom for help at one point, and Edom refused to help them. They tried to block God's salvation for Israel. And so Edom is the antithesis to God's people. They came to represent the evil in this world. And so that's why they're kind of singled out here in this chapter. Now we're going to look at the end time judgments in this chapter in two parts, so two kind of subpoints here. In the first 10 verses, we see pictures of judgment. And in the last part of the chapter, we see the goal of God's judgment. So let's start with the pictures of God's judgment. Notice four pictures. The first picture is found in verse 2. You'll see God's anger. The Lord is angry with all the nations, furious with all their armies. Friends, at the end of time, God's wrath is going to explode onto the scene, like the bursting of a dam. And look at the end of verse 3. It says, their slain will be thrown out, and the stench of their corpses will rise. The mountains will flow with their blood. So the mountains are going to dissolve into mudslides of human blood. Quite an intense picture, right? And Isaiah doesn't let up as we look at the next two pictures. We see in verse 6, the second and third pictures, a sword and a sacrifice. The Lord's sword is covered with blood at the end of that verse. For the Lord has a sacrifice in Bozrah, which, by the way, is the capital city of Edom. So when God comes to judge, he's bringing the sword, he's making a sacrifice. The guilty will atone for their sins. And so, friends, here's a picture of the great day of judgment at the end of time. God will balance the scales of justice. But here's the amazing thing. The sword that will one day come to judge people came first to judge Christ. He got the sword, didn't he? He became the sacrifice. He experienced the full blast of God's wrath. And so for Christians, he stood in our place. Friends, one way or another, there will be a sacrifice for our sins, either paid for by Christ on the cross or paid for by this sword on this day, at this altar. Christ will be your substitute, or Christ will be your judge. The fourth picture, as you look at verse 8, is a day of vengeance. For the Lord has a day of vengeance, a time of paying back Edom for its hostility against Zion. Now, all of this terrible judgment has actually been scheduled on the calendar of human history. It's sitting up somewhere in God's office right now. And we might have our day and our way right now, but there is coming a time when God will have his day. God's not going to leave things hanging. He's going to right every wrong. And we see what this judgment looks like in verses 9 and 10. Notice the streams and the land and the pitch turned into sulfur and burning and desolation. Now, friends, maybe all of this talk about judgment is kind of crazy talk to you. You know, maybe it kind of offends you a little bit. You might be thinking, gee, God, when if God is so good and so loving, why would he judge us like this? Why is God so irritable in this chapter? It seems like he's kind of like a grumpy old man. Some kid runs across his lawn and starts yelling at him, right? Well, those are good questions. You know, this passage, it reminds us that God takes right and wrong far more seriously than we do. Friends, our sin deserves judgments. That's not hard to believe, you know, because we all want justice. You pick up the newspaper or you turn on television, listen to some news. And basically what we're getting is a steady stream of crazy, right? However you want to spit it as you're looking at the news and listening to all of the things that are going on, whether it's racism or terrorism, men armed with weapons of mass destruction, whether it's a young child who's been diagnosed with terminal cancer. It just seems like the bad guys are winning and the punishment is not fitting the crime. And we feel so helpless and so powerless and so vulnerable in bringing about the justice that this world needs. And so we get worked up, right? We get upset about this, rightly so. Well, friends, what if I told you that God's judgment is God finally bringing the justice we all know this world needs? That doesn't offend us. That sounds pretty good, right? Like ancient Israel, it actually brings us some comfort, and that's a good thing. But you know, the part that we don't like is that God's judgment just might include us or someone we know, maybe a loved one, a friend. It bothers us to think that there's a possibility that we are part of the problem, but we all contribute to the societal problems of today because we are intrinsically, inherently sinful. We are bent out of shape, right? You know what surprises me the most, though? It's not that God will come to judge. It's that he hasn't already. Isn't that nuts to think about? God is far more patient than we would be, right? We experience just a tiny bit of injustice, just a little bit of injustice, and we kind of fly off the handle, right? Someone cuts us off on the road or cuts in front of us in the grocery store, or someone inappropriately criticizes us, and we get all worked up and upset, start yelling and screaming, sometimes out loud, oftentimes internally. We complain to our friends, and we set up picket lines, and we call the reporters and the newspaper folks. We're so impatient, aren't we? But then we look at God, and we say, you can't get worked up, God, right? You need to relax a little. You need to calm down. For the millions and billions of people that have flat out defied you for centuries, Lord, you need to take it easy. And yet for thousands of years, God has waited and waited and waited as billions of people commit sin upon sin upon sin. And right in the middle of all of that, what does he do? He sends Jesus to be judged in the place of sinners. And now he sends his church to tell people the gospel. Friends, God has been patient with his judgment, but incredibly impatient with his grace. He keeps his sword sheathed in heaven while he backs up his dump truck of grace on earth. What an amazing truth. Now, you may be thinking, goodness, Godwin, isn't it abusive to tell people, just like Isaiah does here, isn't it abusive to tell people about God's judgment? Maybe we should only talk about the good stuff, the happy stuff, the joyful stuff, right? I want you to listen to Francis Schaeffer. So here's a mid-20th century apologist and writer and teacher, evangelist. He said this: if I had 1 hour to explain the gospel to someone, I would spend the first 55 minutes on the bad news of judgment and the last 5 minutes on the good news of salvation. Now, obviously, he's exaggerating, but he's trying to make a point. What is he trying to say? Well, I think he's trying to say without judgment, we can't fully understand or appreciate our salvation, right? Jesus didn't just save you from your mistakes and save you from your brokenness. Friends, he saved you from this day here in chapter 34, this day of vengeance with this sword and this altar with your own blood on it. That's what he saved you from. Imagine that. Now, the second thing I want to point out as we're looking at the back half of this chapter is the goal of God's judgment. What's the goal of God's judgment? Looking at verses 11 through 17, it's the unmaking of the world. Now, this part of the chapter is Genesis 1 in reverse. Genesis 1, of course, talks about how God is making the world fit for life, right? Here in chapter 34, we see that judgment is all about God making the world fit for chaos. Look at the end of verse 11 with me. The Lord will stretch out a measuring line and a plumb line over her for her destruction and chaos. Then verse 13, her palaces will be overgrown with thorns, her fortified cities with thistles and briars. She will become a dwelling for jackals and an abode for, and this surprises me, ostriches. Why ostriches, right? I mean, it's kind of, Lord, why do you not like ostriches? They're the ostriches. our functioning society will be transformed, devolving into a howling wilderness with creepy animals and overgrown thorns and super annoying weeds. Streams are transformed into tar pits and the land is burned up, very much reminiscent of what you see in the judgment at Sodom and Gomorrah. Now, look at the second half of verse 11 one more time. The Lord will stretch out a measuring line, a plumb line over her for her destruction and chaos. More language actually from Genesis. So the measuring line and plumb lines were used in construction. Many of you probably know that. So God is using them here ironically. Typically, they're used to build something, construct something, but God uses them here as instruments of deconstruction. Interesting, right? And notice that the measuring and plumb lines are used for, end of verse 11, they're used for destruction and chaos. Now, those words can be translated, get this, as formless and void. Does that sound familiar? Genesis chapter 1, verse 2, right? Before God steps in and intervenes, the earth was formless and void. So what's happening here in judgment? Well, God becomes the great deconstruction worker. He reverses the good. His judgment is like a massive wrecking ball coming through human history, destroying everything that we built, turning it into a place where only wild animals and weeds can live. Now look at verse 17, how this whole thing closes up here. He has cast the lot for them. His hand allotted their portion with a measuring line. So he's kind of measuring out a portion of judgment for the peoples, the nations. And watch this. They will possess it forever. They will dwell in it from generation to generation. Friends, judgment is not only personal. Judgment is not only all-encompassing. Judgment is forever. In our statement of faith, it says that hell is eternal conscience torment. And those are very, very dramatic words, but it captures even what we see here in this chapter. And friends, we must reckon with this reality. You know, one of the challenges of wrapping our heads and hearts around this is it just feels so disconnected from real life, right? From our everyday experience. I mean, the sun's going to come up tomorrow. We're going to wake up and we're going to have some breakfast, and we're going to go to work or hang out with our children or hopefully have a nice day with our coworkers, have a great time maybe at home in the evening with dinner, right? And we go to bed and we wake up again. And we assume there will be a tomorrow, and judgment is this kind of like strange myth-like thing far out in the future. This day of vengeance, okay, fine, I kind of believe it, I guess, but it's a future day. It's not a present reality. It's end of the world stuff. We kind of dismiss it a little bit. But friends, we just don't know when this day will come. Perhaps there are some in this room that are like Israel, some who are very religious but not spiritually alive. And I just got to warn you, I want to exhort you just for a few moments. If you've made allegiances with this world, if you've been worshiping the idols of Babylon more than you've been considering Christ, maybe you've been running through the spiritual motions, you've been attending church for a long time, but you know, deep down in your heart, you are not truly spiritually alive to God. Would you repent and believe? Maybe you've even been baptized. Maybe you've spent some time back there with one of the pastors. Maybe you read your Bible now and then. Maybe you just show up to church on Easter and Christmas. But if you have truly not been made alive by the Spirit of God, there's no affection in your heart for Jesus, would you repent and believe today? Today is the day of salvation because tomorrow might be the day of vengeance. We just don't know. You know, sometimes we forget that judgment might very well touch the people we love, right? And we spiritualize that. You know, I don't think they're ready to hear the gospel. I need to spend more time building this friendship with them, and so I need to give it another 18 years or so before I can talk to them about Jesus, right? And so the Lord wants me to wait, and there's always time until there's not. I think of my friend Pete, who became a Christian late in life, and he and his dad had a very difficult relationship over the years, and they would see each other during holidays and Christmas and so forth, and they would be cordial, but there wasn't a lot of warmth there. And Pete thought to himself, I need to share about Jesus with my dad. He still loved him. But he just wasn't willing to cross that pain line, that pain threshold. And so he kept delaying and delaying and delaying. And then all of a sudden, his dad was diagnosed with stage 4 terminal cancer. And he had about 6 months to live. And Pete started reflecting on the reality of hell, but also the reality of heaven. He started reading and studying scriptures, and he was just so moved by what he was studying that he thought, I need to cross this pain line. And so he goes over to his dad's house, and he makes him some tea, and he sits down in front of him, and he tells him about Jesus. And they have a long conversation that started out awkward. There were moments of frustration. There was moments even of conflict and arguments in that conversation. But at the end of that conversation, which was many hours long, his dad became a Christian. And they embraced in the middle of that living room. And then his dad died 3 days later. He took the step of faith in sharing Christ. Now, what about you and me? Do we have a painful memory of not taking that step? You know, I don't say that to load you up with unhealthy guilt, but we just have to remember that God has a godly sorrow sometimes that he puts in our hearts to drive us to be more faithful as his people, right? Think about two brothers that I've talked to here at Faith Church who have both told me separately over the last few years there were loved ones that they wanted to share Jesus with, and they just didn't cross that pain threshold. And their loved one passed away, and they just, you could see the agony on their face. And yet the Lord used that agony to drive them to consider the scriptures, to drive them to consider being more faithful in their evangelism. You know, I'm not asking you to freak out and go on an evangelistic rampage, even though that would not be the worst thing. But let's not delay. Let's not delay. We don't feel the weightiness of our mortality. We need to feel that. And I hope this morning, as we're looking at chapter 34, you're feeling that to some extent. May the reality of judgment, the heaviness that we feel as we look at chapter 34, may it wake us up to being more faithful in our Christian lives and mission. So that's chapter 34, the wilderness of judgment. We can all take a deep breath now. We're going to move into some good territory here as we look at the garden of salvation in chapter 35. Now, before we dive into this chapter, we need to consider again the context. So the golden age of David, the golden age of Solomon is long gone. So now you've got these Israelite kings who are trying to make alliances and allegiances with these pagan nations. And so Israel, even though they were complicit to some extent, they were also wondering, what's going to happen to us? Will God help us? Will God intervene? Will God save us? And I wonder whether we feel like that sometimes too in the 21st century. We look around at our changing post-Christian, post-everything context and our legs start to shake a little bit and our hands get sweaty, right? What's going to happen to our freedom of worship? Will our churches be shut down inappropriately? I mean, not even public restrooms are free of controversy these days, right? And so there's so much evil and confusion and injustice that's seeping from our culture, even into the church, or threatening the church, or imposing itself on the church. So the question is, do we have hope? And of course, you know the answer to that. We absolutely do. And in this chapter, we get to see that hope, how God has promised salvation to his people. And we see two aspects of salvation I want to point out to you, so two subpoints under this one. First, we see the goal of salvation, then we're going to see pictures of salvation. So looking at the first 7 verses, the goal of salvation. And here's the goal. It's recreation. It's remaking. I want you to notice what happens to the desert. Look at verses 1 and 2 of chapter 35. The wilderness and the dry land will be glad. The desert will rejoice and blossom like a wildflower. It will blossom abundantly and will also rejoice with joy and singing. So this wilderness is going to flourish and bloom. There's going to be new life, right? Notice verse 2. The glory of Lebanon will be given to it, the splendor of Carmel and Sharon. Lebanon in verse 2 was known for its thick forests. Carmel means garden land. Sharon was known for its fruitful fields. So these are places of abundance and life and health. Look at the end of verse 6. Water will gush in the wilderness and streams in the desert. The parched ground will become a pool and the thirsty lands springs. What do we see here? We see the land that was burned up in chapter 34. Now it's turned into these bubbling springs, and it's flourishing with life. You know, picture the desert, the vast desert out west somewhere. You know, these vast regions of sand suddenly transformed into a fruitful rainforest with beautiful flowers and streams of clear water, everything in full bloom. The wilderness will be turned into one of the most beautiful and fruitful places known to Isaiah's first readers. So what's going on here? Well, Isaiah is showing us a picture of the end. The new heavens and the new earth, the new paradise, the new Garden of Eden. Here's a picture of salvation right here. You know, sometimes the Bible tells us what salvation is all about. Think about the Apostle Paul as he articulates in his letters, this is what salvation is. Well, sometimes the Bible shows us what salvation is through picture and metaphor and poetry. And that's what we see here. But it's not just a place that's transformed. Notice it's a people as well. Look at verses 3 and 4. Strengthen the weak hands, steady the shaking knees. Say to the cowardly, be strong, do not fear. Here is your God. Vengeance is coming. God's retribution is coming. He will save you. And the eyes of the blind will be opened and the ears of the deaf unstopped. Then the lame will leap like a deer and the tongue of the mute will sing for joy. Wow. Doesn't this sound like what Jesus came to do? He came to change us, right? Change people. And what do we contribute to this beautiful outcome? Blindness, deafness, lameness, and silence. What does God contribute? Sight and sound and agility and song. It's God's business to make spiritual cripples into world beaters. And today, what about today? Well, today we get a portion of God's recreating work in our hearts. What God will do for the entire world, he first does here and now in our lives when we are converted. Or you can think about it this way. Right now, God is remaking you and me into something suitable for eternity. Isn't that cool? Cool, right? Before the Spirit's work in our lives, there was only a desert. Nothing good growing in us. No life, only cracked, dry ground. But when we repent, when we trust in Jesus and break allegiances with the world, all of a sudden, you see kind of this blade of grass popping out. And you're like, whoa, there's some new life. And it kind of turns into a tree and there's fruit. Friends, have you noticed that many of the illustrations in the Bible for spiritual growth are plants and trees and fruits and vineyards and so forth? That's not accidental. I think Isaiah is using some of that language here. When you become a Christian, a little garden shows up. And you become a living illustration to the world of what God will do at the end of history when he recreates everything. It's a bit of life to begin with. We can all see it, right? We point it out in each other's lives and encourage each other with what we see. There's a young man who grew up here at Faith Church, and he grew up around the hymns and the songs and the stories, and he was discipled by many of the people here at the church. And then he left the church, and he abandoned his family in some ways, and he lived a licentious, debaucherous life. And he was far, far away out in the metaphorical pigsty of this world, and God saved him and reminded him of the hymns that he sang and the stories that he was taught and the gospel that was preached to him for decades, and he's back here with us. It's a little garden. We get to see it. There's a brother I know who was entrenched in such deep sin for years and years and years. He was married, and he was struggling with this particular addiction. He didn't really believe that it was possible for him to come back from what he had committed himself to. You fast forward 4, 5, 6 years, and you talk to his wife, and she would say, he is unrecognizable to me. How does that happen? A little garden of life springs forth out of nothing because of the Lord's grace and kindness, right? I got my stories, you got your stories. You know, I'm officiating 2 weddings this year. I'm meeting with a few couples for counseling. And without fail, the guy's favorite part of wedding preparation is checking out the catering. You know, guys are involved in 2 things typically in weddings, the food and the honeymoon, right? Those are the 2 things they're interested in. Centerpieces, you got it, honey. Invitations, I don't care. Colors for the wedding, you can decide, right? But food, wait a second, we got to slow down here. Let's really think about this. And so, you know, the the guy and the girl, they go into the caterer, and what do? Well, you get a little sample of the food, right? A little sample piece of cake and maybe a sample entree. You taste just a little bit of the meal that will be given on the great wedding day. Brothers and sisters, that's what we experience right now with God and with each other. Just a little taste, just enough to make us long for the great wedding day, when Jesus will gather his bride from every tribe, tongue, and nation, and he will feast with them, and he will lavish on them a feast. So what's evangelism? Evangelism is giving people a chance to sample heaven. When people come to Christ, they get to taste a little bit of heaven. God, the great caterer, gives them a spoonful of the feast that he will be making for his people at the end of time. A little morsel now, full banquet later. What an exciting mission we have, right? To be a part of this. And it's not just personal or individual evangelism that we should be thinking of. It's the church. The church is the beginning of the new creation. The church, to use Pauline language, is the first fruits of the new creation. The church is a little picture of this end times garden. The church is the place where the fruit of the Spirit is most ripe on earth. And so when a woman who is softly crying while another has her arms around her praying, I've seen that here in this room, that's a picture of the garden. When you invite a non-Christian to your community group and they see your love, your care for one another, and it's not perfect, and this person says something awkward, and that person, you know, is too loud, and you're kind of embarrassed, it doesn't matter. They're getting an appetizer portion of the heavenly garden. We go to a homeless shelter and serve a meal and sit down and we talk to people and we laugh with them. And they're smelling the fragrance of God's garden. Friends, this is our task. But it's really a privilege, isn't it? Let's be honest. To invite others into the joy of this garden, to invite them into the joy of this fellowship. Is there anything better? There's no other group. I get emotional thinking about this in the first service too, but it's been 3.5 years since my family and I have been here, and I just got to say, there's no other group on this planet that I'd rather lock arms with in displaying this garden than you. When I look at this congregation, I see a garden that is growing more fruitful and more lush, more beautiful with every sermon listened to and every Bible study attended and prayer prayed, with every effort to love, with every trial that you endure, I get to see either from a distance or close up. The garden is growing by God's grace here at Faith Church. And so, friends, we got to guard this garden. Don't let the devil destroy this garden. Don't let your sin steal the Spirit's fruit from this garden. Now, why do I say it? It's because of what we talked about last week, right? It's not just individual Christians who evangelize. The whole church displays the gospel and promotes the garden. So recreation, that's the goal. Now let's look at some pictures of salvation. So we look at the last few verses, verses 8 through 10. This whole chapter really is a big picture. It's really an Exodus-based poem. And so Isaiah, the author, he's taking the Exodus, which is, of course, you know, a few books back, and that's the story of the Exodus and kind of the theological message of Exodus. And he's kind of importing it here in this chapter. So pilgrims through a desert land finding their environment changing. Summoned out of slavery, renewed for their heavenly journey, on the highway to God's city. That's what we see here. Notice verse 8. A road will be there and a way. It will be called the Holy Way. The Holy Way. Here's a highway. Here's a road that leads, interesting, out of the wilderness, right? So salvation, first of all, is a road out of the wilderness. Notice who can't walk on it. The unclean can't, fools can't. But notice also it's a safe place. There's no lion, there's no vicious beasts on this path. So there's this kind of narrow path. Jesus talks about the narrow path, right? It's the way of Christ, the way of holiness. But it's a safe path. It's narrow, but it's safe, even though there's a howling wilderness all around. The other picture, notice in verse 10, is a city, Zion. The redeemed of the Lord will return and come to Zion with singing, crowned with unending joy, joy and gladness will overtake them, and sorrow and sighing will flee. So this holy way leads to God's great city. Friends, salvation is a journey, not only out of the wilderness, but a journey to our true home. In the Bible, Zion is used in a few different ways. It refers to the city of Jerusalem in the Old Testament, to the mountain of God. In the Psalms, it's used to describe God's dwelling place, so it's referring to the temple. But in the New Testament, it refers to the final home for God's people. And notice in verse 10, it's a place of what? Unending joy. Let that sink in. Unending joy. Our days today, as we walk into our Mondays tomorrow, maybe we'll experience some joy and happiness, but they will be fleeting. Maybe there will be a season of joy, but that chapter will close at some point. And so we're always restarting, right, with joy. We encounter a roadblock. We encounter pain. Chapter 34 details how judgment is forever. Chapter 35 tells us that joy will be forever. That chapter in our lives, once we get into the new heavens and new earth, will not end. And notice the final verse of this chapter. Joy will overtake them and sorrow will flee. Think about this. One day when you're on the cusp of planting your feet on the new earth, if you know Jesus, you will be overtaken. You will be overwhelmed with joy, super saturated with joy. A tidal wave of joy will come over you. And meanwhile, sorrow will run away. This is a picture of where this highway leads. It's incredible, right? And why is there so much joy? We got to ask this question. Why is there so much joy when we finally go home to Zion? I want you to hear these words from the apocalyptic writer John in Revelation 21. He answers that question. Why is there a tsunami of joy when we get to Zion? Listen to this. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth. For the first heaven, the first earth had passed away and the sea was no more. I also saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, Zion, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared like a bride adorned for her husband. And then I heard a loud voice from the throne. Look, God's dwelling is with humanity, and he will live with them. They will be his people, and God himself will be with them and will be their God. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes. Death will be no more. Grief and crying and pain will be no more, because the previous things have passed away. Why this tsunami of joy? Well, simple answer is this. God will be there. God will be there. Friends, this is why we evangelize. This is it right here. We do it for the everlasting joy of people. God has made a way for people to be with him. And the psalmist says, in your presence is fullness of joy and pleasures forevermore. And we can experience a taste of that joy now, here in the now, but it's coming as a tidal wave at the end of this time. So let's tell the world, right? Let's tell the world. We got the best news on this planet. Don't think of evangelism as a burden. Think of it as a privilege. You get to help people get on this path of unending joy. They don't have to live in the desert of their sin. They don't have to waste away in the barrenness of their pain. There is a garden out there. It's full of life. There's a God out there who's going to bring you to his city. And the chapter of pain will come to a close. And you and they will only experience fullness of joy. Friends, when was the last time you pleaded with God to save someone? When was the last time you wept because someone is rejecting Jesus? You know what's going to move us beyond the pain line? It's two things, two kind of motivational pieces. The first is this, a passion for the glory of God and the salvation of sinners. That God can be known, that God can be delighted in, that God can be worshiped by more people. That's the first kind of overriding motivation that should drive us to cross that pain line. But there's also something else. Deep compassion, an unrelenting concern for the destiny of our friends and our sisters and our brothers and our prodigal children and our family and our neighbors and our coworkers. The key to evangelism isn't having all the answers. None of us do. The key isn't zero fear. None of us will have zero fear in our lives. The key is love. Happy Valentine's Day. The key is love. First, love for God, and then love for others. Friends, when our hearts are so gripped by the horrors of hell and so moved by the beauties and the glories we find in heaven, we're going to open our mouths. We're going to tell them about Jesus. We're going to tell them about this garden and this city and this path. It's not going to be hard. We're going to open our mouths, and what are we going to tell them? We're going to tell them that when Jesus hung on the cross, the giver of life became a barren, lifeless desert for us. That his body was broken, his blood was shed, so you can have life. So you can be a flourishing garden. So you can walk the holy way to this joyful city. So you can have God. That's what we're going to tell him. If you're not a Christian this morning, would you consider this gospel? And if you are a Christian, who might the Lord lead you to tell this to this week? Let's take a moment of silence now as we consider this passage and prepare ourselves for the Lord's Supper.